here. This do people who pass these these types of laws or attempt to pass them have any idea what Sharia law even is, and how it is part of more of a cultural artifact and something that governs people's personal lives?
We've got
30 seconds. I'm sorry to say that. So I guess we're going to wrap up. So if you want to just leave us with some thoughts, with a brief thought on that.
I would just say that a number of sponsors of these bills do not have a complete understanding of Islam, and that they are using these bills to fearmonger, and that any time we say it's the same old hate, it's just a new target. And so we're here fighting for our constitutional rights. So down the road, the next community, which suffers from, you know, the same type of anti-immigrant hate, that, you know, their rights are being protected.
Thanks so much for that. My guest has been Robert McCall, Government Affairs Manager with the Council on American Islamic Affairs. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, March 30th, 2015. Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned. Locus Focus coming right up.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the 4th annual Umbrella Festival of Circus and Comedy, April 2nd to April 5th at the Alberta Rose Theater. 4 nights of entertainment, including outsider music legend Artist the Spoon Man, 9 traveling circus troupes, acrobats and aerialists, clowns and cabaret, bands and burlesque, drag and daring do, and more. Again, that's the 4th annual Umbrella Festival of Circus and Comedy, April 2nd through April 5th at the Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Since the dawn of civilization, humans have destroyed or badly damaged perhaps 3/4 of the world's forests. While forests have been reestablished in many regions across the Northern Hemisphere, they are under increasing assault in the tropics. This morning we speak with Rolf Skaar, Forest Campaign Director of Greenpeace, about efforts to stop the spread of tropical deforestation and initiatives to promote reforestation as well. Prior to joining Greenpeace, Rolf was campaign director for the Siskiyou Project here in Oregon, and during that tenure, he was featured in my 2007 radio documentary, Sculpted by Fire. Last time we had Rolf on, we were talking about palm oil plantations. Rolf, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me again, Barbara.
Well, I wanted to kind of look at maybe the contrasting and similar challenges you have across the landscapes that you have fought to protect, going back to when we first met when you were trying to protect the area that had been burned in the Biscuit Fire from salvage logging, going to Indonesia where you've worked with Greenpeace to try to stop the ravages of the rainforest there in the name of palm oil, and to the work that you've also been doing in Africa and Brazil. On the one hand, you've worked with trying to protect fire-prone landscapes from clear-cutting and then from salvage logging. On the other hand, you're dealing with some of the luscious landscapes in the world, which don't have the same kind of troubles that the Siskiyou wildlands have in growing back. So what do you see as the common challenges that you've been facing?
Well, the common challenges are the pressures that an increasingly large human population and increasing consumption across the globe are putting on forests everywhere. Another compounding factor that's a similarity is the increasing impact from a changing climate on forests in different regions. Those impacts and those threats are different, but they feel familiar at times to me.
Well, actually, the article that inspired me to get in touch with you, to put you on the show, was an article in the New York Times a couple months ago about efforts to reforest and some of the successes in reforesting tropical rainforests. And one of the thread lines in the article was the importance that tropical rainforests play, and all forests for that matter play, in being major carbon sinks. And somebody was quoted in the article saying, instead of coming up with all these convoluted, expensive carbon sequestration projects, we should just leave forests intact. So let's talk a little bit about what is the role that particularly the tropical rainforests play in carbon sequestration.
Well, they're huge carbon sinks. If you look at the Amazon rainforest, the Congo Basin in Africa, and then the tropical rainforest in Southeast Asia, primarily Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, they are, you know, gigatons worth of carbon both above and below the soils. In parts of Indonesia, there's a special soil type that you find in some other parts of forests around the world. It's called a peatland, and those peatlands are basically big carbon piggy banks. They've been storing carbon that's fallen down from the forests and leaf litter for many, many years. And because those the water table is very high, the carbon doesn't break down and it turns into a deep, dark store of carbon. So there are many gigatons worth of CO2 locked up in forests around the world. And as the observer that you just mentioned points out, stopping deforestation and restoring forests is probably the easiest short-term solution to make some big emissions cuts that we know scientists have told us we very much need.
Well, I know you also have worked some on the boreal forests in the northern latitudes. And as you're talking about the peat bogs in Indonesia, I guess mm-hmm. that are when they put in the palm oil plantations, we can talk about in a moment, you disrupt those peat bogs. And the same process goes on when they're extracting bitumen to create tar sands oil up in northern Alberta. And I wanted to talk about the sort of the double whammy, I guess, mm-hmm. particularly in the case of tar sands extraction. How does we look a lot at the carbon footprint of the actual extraction of tar sands oil and burning, you know, and the burning of it. But how does the extraction and disruption of the peat bogs add and really magnify the impacts of carbon emissions?
Well, see, a lot of people know that trees, you know, take in CO2 and give out oxygen, and that much is usually where the dialogue stops about climate impacts of logging or deforestation. But when you look at an ecosystem like a peatland forest, those forests are doing more than just supporting the standing trees that are sucking in carbon. They're sitting on top of lots of stored carbon and then other potent greenhouse gases like methane, which can also be released when you disrupt or destroy a peat forest ecosystem. So that can be a double whammy. On top of that, you know, you're losing, in a case of something like a mine or establishment of a plantation that permanently gets rid of that, what was there before, the peat forest, you're talking about losing that sequestration ability over time. And then let us not forget that, you know, some level of global warming will be happening, some level of climatic shift will be happening over time, you know, despite some of our best efforts to curb emissions. And forests will be a key component of us being able to mitigate and adapt to the effects of climate change. So whether it's a drought or whether it's flooding, you know, you want forests around to help cushion the effect of climate change.
Well, I've read some, I think actually in that same article in the New York Times, kind of seeing keeping forests in place and growing more forests as a way of bridging the bridging that gap, so to speak, until we get to a place where we are burning only, or not burning, but we're using only renewable fuels. I wonder if we can look at what is that process? How will forests actually kind of be the bridge mechanism for us to reach, to sort of cross over into our climate challenge future?
Yeah. Well, bring it back to that comparison, you know, things like carbon capture and sequestration, you know, have been proven so far to be not effective in terms of cutting emissions on any significant level and might even increase them over time. We are starting to see shifts in the way that we make electricity in the U.S. You know, there's an ongoing shift to solar as the technologies get cheaper and more available, but we still know that will take time. The great thing about forests is that if you just stop messing them up, they do their job. And right now, deforestation, last couple of years, has been, you know, near the number two cause of human-caused climate emissions. The effects, the actual emissions from deforestation have been that high. They've been larger than all the cars, trains, planes, and boats in the world combined. And so it's a huge source of pollution. And people scratch their heads and wonder about that. It's CO2 that's released from the soils, from the actual standing biomass as well. And then in the case of the tropics, where you really see some of the worst deforestation and emissions, it's because these forests are literally being burned down just to get rid of them in order to replace them with something else, usually a plantation. So if we can just stop the deforestation, you know, it's like turning off the light switch, and suddenly, you know, the forests are giving us a global benefit. So that's why I think a lot of climate scientists look at forests and an end to deforestation in the near term as the most viable bridge to a stable climate.
I'm thinking about deforestation. I'm just kind of remembering my last trip to the Oregon coast a couple of weeks ago and driving along Highway 26 and seeing all those clear cuts. And there's new clear cuts that I hadn't seen The last time I was there. And so we have a sense here in the Northwest of just how much has been cut down and how much could be saved. How does that compare with how much is being cut down in the tropics?
Well, right now the tropics have, you know, a deforestation rate that is truly startling. And, you know, before taking this job with Greenpeace about 8 years ago, I worked a lot on national forests in the Northwest, as you know. And I thought I'd seen the worst of it. And I hadn't, unfortunately. If you fly over parts of the Amazon rainforest, if you fly over parts of Indonesia's rainforest, like in the island of Sumatra, you know, you'll probably have the same reaction that I had when I first saw it, which is, you know, a jaw-dropping moment, sort of speechless, because you see conversion of natural rainforest as far as the eye can see. And again, this is conversion that isn't so much like a silvicultural operation where they're planting and clear-cutting, and there's huge problems with that, obviously, that Oregon's quite familiar with, but this is a permanent replacement with something else so that it will never be a forest again. And in most cases, it's a monoculture of a non-native tree species like eucalyptus to make pulp and paper, or it's agricultural conversion for something like palm oil. In the case of the Amazon, it's mostly cows and other agriculture like soy to feed animals.
Well, that was actually done here 150 years ago. I mean, it wasn't like Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, all forest land at one time.
Yeah, you know, the big ecosystem in the center of the continental U.S. is tall grass prairie, of which, you know, almost nothing remains, you know, quite literally scraps. There's all of that was plowed under for agriculture and largely for animal agriculture. And so it is familiar in that way, too. So in a sense, you know, these countries are doing nothing out of the ordinary. The unfortunate thing is that, you know, we have the benefits of hindsight now, and to understand that rather than repeating the mistakes of the past and imperiling a planet on a global scale, because the emissions from these forests in the tropics are huge, and we're losing all kinds of biodiversity and peoples and cultures in the process, rather than repeating the mistakes of the past, we think we have a shot at sketching out a clean development pathway, one that balances the needs of these countries to develop and to bring people out of poverty, but also to do so with some smart planning.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Rolf Skaar, who is the Forest Campaign Director for Greenpeace. And we're talking about, so far we've been talking about the intense deforestation of the tropical rainforests around the world. And I'd like to shift now into talking about slowing down deforestation and actually doing some reforestation, which this show was inspired by an article I read a few weeks ago in the New York Times that actually quoted Rolf. You've got one sentence in that article, but it made me think it'd be really good to talk to you again to see what you're up to and just get your take on this really pressing problem. I think that one of the most dramatic images, at least in my mind, of deforestation versus forest protection is one of the aerial view of the island of Hispaniola, which houses the Dominican Republic on one side and Haiti on the other side. And I actually had the opportunity to fly over that island about 9 years ago. And it is really astonishing because on the east part of the island, it's big, lush tropical rainforests. On the west part of the island, which is Haiti, it's totally denuded. And I wanted to talk a little bit about maybe what caused that disparity and what the environmental and other consequences of denuding Haiti have been.
Yeah. Well, you know, this isn't unusual. If you look at islands around the world that are divided between two different nation states, with a satellite, you can very quickly see the role that that governments play. So the difference between relatively good governance and bad governance, or just lack of governance at all, can play. And primarily, you know, the way that land is allocated. So who has rights to the land, and you know how are they allowed to use that land? That makes all the difference in the world. And so you can see this in between the DR and Haiti. You can see it in on the island of Papua, which on the west side is Indonesian, and on the east side is Papua New Guinea. Similar stories are being borne out again and again, based on the governance. And so, with better laws and better regulations and better oversight of land use and some common sense planning, you can keep forests standing while you develop. But in Haiti, where of course there's been a real rocky ride in terms of the government there, the natural disasters, all the rest of it, you quickly see forests falling, oftentimes not in a planned way, but just because people are doing it and there's no one there to stop them. And they're often doing it out of desperation.
It sort of reminds me a little bit of Easter Island, which I understand was heavily wooded at one time, and it's one of the theories about the demise of Easter Island had to do with it, the people completely logging the island. I don't know if you have any sense about that or if there's much... I understand that whole assumption about the demise is a bit contentious.
Yeah, I've read the theories with interest, and I think the lessons learned are certainly applicable to us today, whether or not all archaeologists and historians, you know, agree to it. You know, there are limits to natural forest ecosystems, and there's only so much that we can take from them. And so, you know, when we say we want an end to deforestation, that's what Greenpeace is campaigning on now, is zero deforestation as quickly as possible. Some people say that's crazy, but I want to point out to folks that we will have an end to deforestation one way or the other, and we'll lose all of our native forests one way or the other. It's just a question of whether we'll plan to do it, we'll deliberately get there, or if we'll just sort of accidentally arrive one day and wonder why we didn't do things differently.
So you're saying the end of deforestation will either be the end of forests, or before that, if we stop before that, then we might have a few forests left over?
That's right. You can just cut through it all without giving it a thought. Or you can have a plan, and you can decide where to do active forest management and logging and agriculture, and which forests should be set aside for all the other benefits that they give us. So zero deforestation doesn't mean never cutting another tree. It means protecting what's left of our native ecosystems, restoring forests where it makes sense to do so for things like watersheds or habitat connectivity. And for climate resilience, and then having development and economic activity in areas where you're not affecting those important forests, those remaining forests.
Now, I'm curious, and you mentioned Papua as being another island where there's a big divide between, depending on which part of the island is being governed by whom. And in that case, which government is the one that's better protecting the forests?
Well, it's a little bit up in the air these days, but in Papua New Guinea, there's more traditional land rights, so sort of smaller chunks of land that typically are held by local people who have been forest dependent, since they've been there for very long times, and so they in Papua, in West Papua in Indonesia, it's a very similar culture, but the framework, the rules that the Indonesian government are applying to it are different. So it makes it easier for large-scale things like giant agriculture plantations to be planned and to be put in place, or for giant infrastructure projects, drilling for oil, that sort of thing. That's unfortunately starting to happen more and more in Papua New Guinea as well, as Western countries and countries desperate for that country's rich natural resources, especially in petroleum and mining, start moving in and bribing local officials and taking advantage of their dominance in terms of, you know, the sort of the financial resources that they have compared to local communities.
Well, that seems to be one of the biggest challenges in protecting forests. Is, I mean, you have places like Papua New Guinea and Costa Rica, which is more a case, I guess, of regrowing forests, because I guess they also kind of destroyed their forests at one time. But there's places around the world which are noted for either ancient traditions that have protected the forests, or modern thinking that's much more ecological, that's gone back and reforested. But there's these other economic pressures, which you just mentioned. And how do you create some kind of infrastructure so that you can protect the traditional forest rights of the people that live there and the traditional forests from the pressures of global capital?
Well, it's complicated, not easy, but one thing that Greenpeace has had some success with is, you know, looking at a particular place, let's say Sumatra in Indonesia, and looking at the top drivers of deforestation. In Sumatra's case, you know, the big two are really palm oil and then pulp and paper plantations, where they're just, you know, again, bulldozing or burning down the forest and replacing it with a non-native plantation. And if you trace those commodities, like where does the palm oil go? Where does the paper go? If you trace those carefully through research back up the supply chains to the companies that are ultimately paying for that deforestation, you know, these are the end users and customers. This is why this is happening in the first place. Then you've got some leverage, and you can use the power of the marketplace to be part of the solution rather than just the problem. So what we usually do is we trace those commodities back up to big users, like Procter & Gamble, for example, is one of the largest buyers of palm kernel oil on the planet, and we demand that they, you know, take responsibility for their supply chain and don't just look the other way and pretend like that's someone else doing it. If you're actually the ones who are ultimately paying the bills, you need to take responsibility for that. And so a lot of companies are increasingly seeing the light and starting to say that they want commodities that are free of deforestation and that are also respect local people's rights and they free prior and informed consent of indigenous peoples before some sort of, you know, land-altering operation starts on their traditional lands. And you know, the good thing about the marketplace is that money talks. And so if money's talking in the right way, it can actually help push governments to reform. And we're starting to see that in places like Indonesia and the Brazilian Amazon, where companies are demanding, you know, if we're going to keep doing business with you guys, you need to meet certain standards. And that wakes the government up to the fact that some of this corruption and some of the chaos that happens in land use planning needs to be rooted out.
Well, then the other side is that once you start to turn things around, how do you enforce the new set of regulations, the new set of ethos that is trying to be put in place?
Well, that's a good question, because, you know, pledges on paper are just that, and they don't make change on the ground by themselves. And so in the case of, you know, Procter & Gamble, you know, Greenpeace asked that not only do they make this pledge, but they have traceability back down to the ground in Indonesia, like where is this palm kernel oil coming from, and that they report on that, and that they use third parties to audit their supply chains as well, so that we can all see how they're doing in terms of meeting the spirit of their paper pledges. The other thing that's happening is, you know, there's a I don't believe that technology will fix everything for us, and a lot of times technology has made some of the problems that we find ourselves struggling with right now. But in the case of monitoring what's going on with forests, some recent investments by Google and scholars working together have made it quite a bit easier to actually monitor what's happening in remote and often dangerous parts of the world through satellite imagery. And so there's some exciting ways in which, you know, people with just a laptop can actually zoom in on what's going on in parts of Sumatra and actually see see what's going on and even who's responsible for either good or bad management. And so there's increasing transparency thanks to technology these days.
So once I go to Google Maps and I zero in on some really horrible forest ravages in Sumatra, what do I do next?
Well, you know, that's the thing, is that third-party monitors need to report on who's accountable. And so if we find that a Procter & Gamble supplier is burning down rainforest in Sumatra, we can pick up the phone and call Procter & Gamble and say, it looks like, you know, you've got a violation of your supply chain policy, and you better either cut these folks off, in which case you're removing their incentive for clearing the forest, or, you know, fix the problem. And so that's getting easier and easier to do from desktops. There's a group called the Forest Trust, TFT for short, and they're pioneering ways to really make this accessible, this sort of technology accessible for everyday users. And so they have web interfaces where, you know, if they work with a big palm oil trader, for example, you can log in and see where the sort of land is that they're getting palm oil from. And then you can also see what's going on in terms of forest cover. And so and then it makes it quite easy to start a dialogue with the company. Or, you know, if we have to, push a little harder and you know, get media attention around the fact that company is saying one thing and doing another, and that customers aren't going to be very happy about that.
Well, it kind of reminds me a little bit of that famous webcam on the BP oil spill in 2010 that allowed people to see graphically that BP and the United States government was really lying about how the magnitude of that oil spill. Are you seeing a similar kind of movement because of the accessibility of these cameras to and the satellite images to actually see what's going on the ground?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you can see it from your laptop these days. If you there's some programs to help folks sort of adopt an acre, you know, where you're sort of watching what's going on in a given forest track over time, and then reporting if deforestation seems to be starting. There's great new sort of crowdsourcing forest protection initiatives using old cell phones strapped to trees that can actually detect the sound of chainsaws and send off an alarm. So, you know, in many protected areas in the tropics, a place can be a national park, but there's still plenty of logging and illegal land clearance happening in those areas just because there isn't a guard on every corner of the park charging admission. You know, it's still sort of, if you will, the Wild West. And so new technologies are letting, you know, putting power in the hands of people to report and track and hold those accountable, you know, in places like Indonesia and the Amazon and the tropics.
Well, I find it kind of ironic in a way that these technologies that a lot of civil rights activists have been complaining about, civil liberties activists, that these technologies that invade our privacy, that are able to gather huge amounts of data on unsuspecting public, actually can be turned around and be used for the public good.
Yeah, it is ironic. And, you know, I just mentioned old cell phones, and of course the heavy metals that go into those are often being pulled out of rainforests in the Congo Basin and involved with slave labor and child labor. So there's a lot of bad out there, and there's a lot of good that's associated with technologies. I think we should get as much good out of it as we can in an imperfect world.
Well, another challenge, it seems, when we're trying to stop these forest practices is that there are often splits within indigenous communities, whether we see it in northern Alaska around drilling for oil in the Anwar, or whether it has to do with populations on Papua New Guinea that could benefit if environmental practices were kind of let go of and ignored. So how do you have community discussions? How do you bring together these different parts of the community that have different interests at stake?
Well, that's a good question, and it's not easy, and it's very complicated. I'll say in general that traditional communities and indigenous peoples, if you look around the world, the forests that they manage, that they care for, are their traditional lands, are generally best managed in their hands. You know, so whether you're talking about Mexico or Papua New Guinea, the traditional peoples who have lived there and who have both sustained and been sustained by those forests are probably the best people to keep doing that. We don't need to fix what's broken. And actually, just respecting Native and Indigenous peoples' rights and their traditional land rights would do a lot to protect forests around the world. There's an example of this in the case of Brazil, where on the books, Brazil has relatively good rules about indigenous people's lands, the way that they need to be respected, and many of the dark green, quote-unquote, protected areas in the Brazilian Amazon are actually indigenous reserves that are set aside for use by those traditional peoples. The problem is that, you know, there's chaos and corruption out there, and that there's a lot of illegal logging and land clearance that happens even in those places. And unfortunately, there's a lot of violent conflicts happening right now in places like the Brazilian Amazon, where illegal loggers are quite literally coming to blows with traditional peoples whose land is being threatened. So Greenpeace does its best to support those folks. In the case of the Brazilian Amazon, there's one good case study where we actually helped a community map out their traditional lands using sort of our technologies and their traditional wisdoms. And then, you know, that allowed them to file with the Brazilian government to, you know, a formal petition to protect their traditional lands. And we just celebrated about the 10-year anniversary of that a couple of years ago. So the Dene people now in the Brazilian Amazon are celebrating their new, quote-unquote, traditional lands that are protected, partly because of some support.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Rolf Skaar, who's with Greenpeace, and we're talking about protecting tropical rainforests as a benefit on many, many levels, not the least of them being that they are one of the greatest carbon sinks on the planet and can really help us to mitigate climate change, but also looking at all the other values of keeping the tropical rainforests, or what's left of them, intact. One of the things about Brazil that I think about is that there has been a long history of corruption there in the government, which when Lula became president and there was a more of a populist, left-leaning government in charge, there was hope that indigenous people in the Amazon would be treated more fairly and protected. But it seemed like that didn't happen, or at least for a long time. But are you seeing changes now happening in Brazil that are giving more teeth to the regulations that they have on paper?
Brazil is back and forth when it comes to the government, and right now there's a bit of a political crisis in Brazil, and it's not quite clear where things are going or even if this president will survive politically. So, you know, politics are volatile, and we've seen Brazil take a few steps forward and a few back. In general, Brazil, you know, of the big tropical forest countries, has had the best approach to deforestation. They've had the best systems in place to monitor what's going on in remote areas and to require things like, you know, registering your land, you know, officially with the state, so we know who controls what land, and it's not just sort of chaos out there. But they take some steps back too. Some recent revisions to some of the national forest regulations, the forest code, as they call it down there, was sort of a blow to conservation, and it was a reward for some of the big agricultural interests. The one thing that persists through all of that political turmoil is marketplace pressure. And if anything, the incentives now through the marketplace to address deforestation, to address things like slave labor and social injustice and indigenous people's rights, have strengthened. And so, you know, the big soy trader, Cargill, you know, a U.S.-based company, one of the biggest private companies in the United States, is a huge player in Brazil on soy. And, you know, their resolve to ensure the soy that they're getting doesn't come from plantations that have been, you know, from recently cleared rainforests, Cargill's resolve, you know, hasn't wavered. It's probably strengthened. And so as long as the money is not part of the problem and it is increasingly part of the solution, I have some optimism that the politics will catch up over time.
Well, when we're on the same side as Cargill, that really gives me some reasons for hope.
Yeah, well, you know, it's strange bedfellows, isn't it? That, you know, you have Greenpeace and Cargill. We don't agree about a lot of things, I can tell you that, you know. But if we can work together to address deforestation, that's a pretty powerful thing, and especially when it makes change on the ground. If you look at graphs of the rate of Amazon deforestation over the years, you can see the point in the graph where the soy traders and producers and end users, you know, created what's called the soy moratorium, or a moratorium on deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon. You can see the graph spike go downwards at that point. So these are powerful marketplace forces that can have an almost immediate effect on the ground.
Now, what about, there's been a lot of effort over the last few years, and the last time you were on the show, we were talking about the palm oil plantations. And I think that was early on in the campaign, and most people didn't know that when they were eating Ben and Jerry's ice cream with palm oil in it, that they were helping to deforest Indonesia. How has that shifted, and what kinds of marketplace collaboration is there to... Is there actually any... Is there a slowdown in the deforestation and the... Of the tropic, of the native forests, and the rapid increase of palm oil plantations?
Well, it's been a huge shift in terms of awareness, and then sort of the responsibility that companies are now taking for their supply chain. So, you know, people have spoken, and at the end of the day, if Procter & Gamble, if the Unilevers and Nestle's of the world don't listen to people, they suffer at the checkout counter. And so those companies and many more have been taking responsibility for the palm oil and the palm oil derivatives that they buy. And then the palm oil traders and producers have had to listen as a result. So as we speak now, you know, a majority of the palm oil that's produced and traded in the world is at least under a paper commitment to end deforestation and to respect human rights. We're in the phase now that, you know, that really matters, which is to see whether those big producers and traders of palm oil, as a result of this marketplace pressure, can actually translate that into on-the-ground action. And they're starting to do that. That doesn't mean that, you know, the story's over, or that things are solved, or that you can eat everything with palm oil in it guilt-free, but it is a sign of some real progress. If you look at the national deforestation rates in Indonesia, deforestation in these big sort of land concessions that are being run by large producers that are selling to the Nestle's and Procter and Gamble's of the world, that deforestation is dropping. But deforestation on the whole in Indonesia is not, because it's a more complicated picture than that. There's a lot of clearance of rainforest that's happening outside of official concession areas, so areas that either haven't been granted to someone officially, or were granted through corruption, or I don't know, someone's just show up and they started, you know, setting up shop. And so that's the next real big challenge for a lot of these marketplace oriented solutions, is to address these this deforestation that's kind of going on outside of official channels.
Well, getting back to palm oil, when we last talked, there seemed to be a campaign to get people to stop using palm oil and to educate people that, first of all, some of its health effects are way overblown. It's that, you know, its health benefits have been way overblown, and that there's actually some issues about whether it's even good for you and whether it's necessary. Is there still a commitment on Greenpeace's part to try to encourage people to find alternatives to palm oil, and to get manufacturers to find alternatives, or are you just trying to find ways to grow palm oil more sustainably?
Yeah, we're trying to make sure that palm oil is just produced without deforestation and human rights abuses, because if you look at the big users of palm oil in the world, like in terms of countries, it's places like India and China, where it's used traditionally as a cooking oil. It's their canola, you know, and it's an important source.
Wait, that's another oil we're trying to stop people from using.
yeah, it's true. But, you know, poor people in India who need to cook with something and who really need the calories too, it's going to be hard to say that they shouldn't, you know, use that oil. The trouble also is, Barbara, that the alternatives generally are less efficient per acre. So, you know, if you're talking about canola oil or any of the other major vegetable oils that could be a replacement, you have to use a lot more land, which probably makes the deforestation pressures even tougher to solve. I've heard some tech companies, some sort of advanced genetic engineering companies, talk about synthesizing alternatives of palm oil in test tubes and that sort of thing, but I think
sounds really scary, actually.
Yeah, there might be some other issues to consider with that. So, what we're trying to say is, look, you know, this is both important for some of the local economies in places like Indonesia, and to consumers in places like India. Let's just find a way to produce it without cutting down the last scraps of rainforest.
Well, in the last few moments, I want to talk about efforts to actually reforest areas. In the New York Times article, they talked about projects in Costa Rica in particular. And it was one place that was basically, I guess, had been a former cattle ranch, and it was all fields, and it was growing back as a rainforest. And there's also some efforts in Brazil to reforest. Are you familiar with any of that, and do you see that as another important step towards kind of regrowing our tropical rainforests?
Yeah, absolutely. We need to we need to stop deforestation, that's clear. And we, at the same time, we should look for opportunities to restore what's been lost. And there are a lot of those. You know, some of those tropical forest ecosystems are pretty resilient if they have reservoirs of the native diversity around. And so if you have, you know, if you have a diversity of trees and shrubs and plants and animals nearby, over time, you know, especially in the tropics where you've got a long growing season, 365, you can see those forests start to come back and you'll start to get some of the benefits that were lost. It's not like having an ancient forest that, you know, has never been messed with, but it's, if you don't have a forest there now, it's better than what you have, that's for sure.
What kind of carbon advantages are there to reforestation?
Huge carbon advantages. You know, quick growing young forests suck in a lot of carbon. They start to put carbon back into soil. And then in places like, Africa, Central America, places that we know are going to be hit by climate change in some severe ways, those forests are starting to be a bulwark against those effects. So whether it's flooding or droughts, keeping the soils intact, restoring watersheds, all of those sorts of things are going to help people weather the effects of climate change over time.
Now, are there sufficient, enough examples of forest reforestation in the tropics that is actually going to make a difference?
Well, that's the thing. It's awfully expensive. It's a Humpty Dumpty problem because once you've messed up a forest, it's a lot harder to put it and more expensive to put it back together again. And that's why Greenpeace and many other groups, you know, are prioritizing just stopping the deforestation and putting a lot of our money and time and effort into that first before trying to put all the pieces back together again. But there are some places where, there's sort of reforestation happening naturally, where it's just sort of coming back without anyone having to pay a lot of money for it. And so I think there's some, with the right kind of land use planning, if we said, okay, this is going to be an area where we'll make sure this forest can kind of regrow itself, there could be some really cost-efficient ways to do that. The real question, though, Barbara, is, you know, what is that land going to be used for, and what are the benefits for the people that live nearby? Because if it's just sort of a park that's off limits, that's not a sustainable development pathway. We have to have a reason why, these forests should keep standing from the perspective of the local peoples. They can't just be big carbon parks, you know, so that northern countries can keep polluting.
So are you hopeful? What are your grounds for optimism in this struggle to preserve the forests?
You know, a mentor of mine many years ago in Portland once taught me the difference between optimism, pessimism, and hope. And so, optimism and pessimism are about the odds. And I'd be lying if I thought that the odds were very good, that we would quickly get to zero deforestation. But that doesn't mean I don't have hope, because I know it's possible. And I've been surprised over the last 8 years of my tenure here at Greenpeace at some of the amazing progress that's been made that I never dreamt I would see.
Well, it's really great to talk with you, Ralph, and I'm happy every so often to see your name in print and see what you're up to. So let's stay in touch and check back in a while to see how the forest reforestation and stopping deforestation is going.
I look forward to it. Thanks, Barbara.
Okay, thanks a whole lot. We've been talking with Ralph Skar, who's the Forest Campaign Director of Greenpeace, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. I'm going to be taking the next month off, and while I'm gone, we'll be broadcast some of the best of Locus Focus. I'm returning on May 4th, and then we'll be talking about geoengineering with David Biello, who's Environment and Energy Editor for Scientific American. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go up with some music by Milton Nascimento. Thanks for listening.
Como então desgarrados da terra, como assim levantados do chão, como embaixo dos pés uma terra, como água escorrendo da mão, como em sonho correr numa estrada, deslizando no mesmo lugar, como em sonho perder a passada e no oco da terra tombar, como então desgarrados da terra, como assim levantados do chão, ou na planta dos pés uma terra, como como andar numa lama sem fundo, como em cama de pó se deitar, num balanço de rede sem rede, ver o mundo de pernas pro ar.
Yeah, it's a half a minute past 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland. Coming right up is Health and Healthcare Forum. Today, Roberta Hall speaks with Charlie Miller and Dan Sayers on the health and safety aspects of